I'm Chris Clifton from Purdue University, although I'm here in my role as I'm a rotating program director at the National Science Foundation. And this panel is titled The Future of Privacy. And as you can tell from looking up, we've really got a set of panelists who are the ones who are going to create the future of what privacy we could have in this new world that's coming up. And so it's, we're really trying to talk about what are the research challenges, what's happening out there, what can we do about it? And these are some of the questions that come up. I mean, the real goal I would like to see coming out of this is ideas, both from our panelists and from the audience, of what is the research agenda for privacy going to be in order to get us into this future where hopefully we have the benefit of all of these wonderful new technologies, and at the same time, we still have the value of having privacy when you want or need it. So let me introduce the panelists. As I said, these are people who are setting the future. Tamara Denning joins us from the University of Utah, where she has just completed her first semester as a faculty member, having completed her PhD at University of Washington last year. She looks at human issues in security and privacy and the interplay of the human issues and technology issues. Apu Kapadia, who is responsible for some of what you've just seen on the screen, is the old man of this crowd, having received his PhD in 2005. He went from University of Illinois to doing a postdoc at Dartmouth and then spending some time at Lincoln Lab, and then has joined the faculty of Indiana University. He's accomplished quite a bit in the privacy arena and was in fact a runner-up a few years ago for the Privacy Enhancing Technologies Award. In fact, I believe it was the first year of the award, 2009? It was close to that. And Arvind Narayanan is our third panelist, is on the faculty of Princeton University, and a 2009 PhD for University of Texas, spent some time as a postdoc at Stanford, and also works in privacy-enhancing technologies. In fact, is a recipient of the PET Award for some of his work looking at fundamental limits of anonymization. Doing a variety of things, looking at other aspects of privacy in the future. So for example, looking at what's going to be happening with our, that nice little privacy technology we've had for years of cache. What happens to that in the future? And in fact, we'll be running a MOOC on eCash, Bitcoin, electronic currency, and talking about some of the privacy issues that come up with that and some of the things we can do. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Tamara. Each of our panelists is going to give a brief presentation about where they see the future of privacy going, and then we'll open it up to questions. So, Tamara?
Thank you. All right. So I wanted to start things off by making a focus of this mini presentation on communication, different kinds of communication, but I wanted to first kind of set the stage for the following presentations and for some of the discussion by really talking about what privacy means, which may seem a bit pedantic, and furthermore, even though this is about the future of privacy, I'm really going to be talking about looking backwards a little bit and having a little bit of reflection. So one of the reasons why I think that it's good to talk about what we mean when we say privacy is that it really is kind of an overloaded term, and sometimes the conversation really gets dragged down if different parties are meaning different things when they're talking, which perhaps particularly comes into play in things like the legal and the policy sphere, which sort of reflects a lot back to the keynote that we heard yesterday. So my apologies for those of you for whom this is a little bit more familiar, but I'm hoping that there are enough of you that haven't spent as much time with privacy theory that this could potentially open up some new avenues in your thinking. So first off, if you think about sort of some of the legal concepts of privacy and you look back a little bit farther, what you see is that really privacy was very intertwined with physical concepts of property. So here we have an example of an excerpt indicating that, you know, by the laws of England, every invasion of private property is a trespass. But if private papers are removed, this is, you know, an extra kind of aggravation. So we really see here that the evolution of what we mean when we're talking about privacy is that privacy in our definitions of privacy, on which we never agree anyway, that's one of its charms, change to react to the technologies that we have. So, of course, many of you may be familiar with, you know, Warren and Brandeis revisiting and starting to really sort of set the standard, at least in the U.S., for what we mean when we're talking about privacy. And there are different aspects of it there that perhaps it's sort of intrusion into solitude, you know, the right to be alone. Or perhaps it's about managing, you know, how we appear to others, and perhaps it's about slander. Or maybe it's even about sort of ownership of intellectual property and ownership of, you know, oneself and one's image. And then outside of the law, in terms of more sort of social theory, we have all kinds of different ideas about how we might view privacy. So my apologies, this is by no means comprehensive, but things like contextual integrity, and many of these theories are going to come up in the later talks. The idea that really privacy depends on kind of what is the appropriate norm and what people expect, so that it's hard to sort of, without going and looking into a particular instance of a technology's usage, understand what privacy ought to mean. Then you have things like privacy regulation, the idea that it's sort of a dynamic management of access to oneself and one's information, where the boundary is always changing. Or you have something like impression management, and this idea that perhaps there's a public sphere and a private sphere, and sort of you're always performing in certain aspects of your public life. And then something that comes up a lot more in the conversation when we talk about big data and privacy is maybe privacy isn't even quite the word to be using, and it's confusing the issue. Maybe what we're really talking about is data abuse and the, you know, data sources that we're pulling off of. There are all different kinds of public data sources, so, you know, why is that violating your privacy if all the sources are public? But that perhaps really the term that we ought to be using is something like data abuse, because you don't like the way that your different public data sources have been combined in a way that, you know, causes you some kind of harm. So maybe all you care about is the effect of how your data is used. So these different kinds of definitions give you an idea that sort of not everyone means the same thing when they're talking about privacy, that privacy definitions evolve in reaction to the technologies that are sort of violating what we perceive to be privacy, and then also that in a sense I think we're coming a little bit full circle, where privacy was, you know, originally this idea that had to do with public items or physical items and properties, then it became a little bit more abstract. But then now we're starting to come full circle, where all of our technologies are really doing a lot of sensing about the physical environment, or even being able to physically make changes and intrude into our environment. So we're really coming full circle to things being quite in the physical realm again. So I wanted to make this about communication. And there are, of course, different kinds of communication, but one that came up during the keynote yesterday has to do with how we can interact with sort of the legal sphere and the policy sphere. And there are a number of sort of technology policy centers that are springing up around the country, but perhaps not as many as we need. And the thing, of course, that I've been focusing on a little bit more is how do we communicate specifically with users? Now, you may have heard the metaphor before that, you know, people, and when they're using their computers, it can be sometimes compared to using a car. When cars were, you know, much more simple, then people could, you know, lift up the hood and see exactly what was inside and, you know, play with things and fix it when it was broken, and they understood what was going on. And now things are very complex inside of cars, and they don't understand what's going on anymore, but on the other hand, they don't need to just drive their car, right? Sort of the inputs and the outputs are a little bit more simple from the user's point of view. So, you know, I might think that, well, cars aren't really a great metaphor for people's interactions with their technologies because there are, you know, so few variables for them to be considering there. But then maybe, again, it's not such a terrible metaphor after all, because even for cars, what people have to deal with is changing. Now we have things like, well, can your Bluetooth interface be hacked? Or, you know, do you need to worry about, you know, somehow your DRM locking down your car when you're trying to do something with it? Do you need to worry about someone using your hands-free, you know, calling interface to eavesdrop on you, or your telematics unit to track you? So maybe it's not such a terrible metaphor after all. But I think it really sort of characterizes the fact that I think we really need to find new ways and better ways to be communicating with people about what their technology is doing and really what their risk equation looks like. So I don't expect all users to become, you know, experts. That's not reasonable. But I do think it's going to become more part of every person's necessary daily skills to get a little bit of a more active hand on sort of what their rough risk equation looks like. So I really wanted to leave you with some questions to think about. Things like, how are our new technologies changing what our definition of privacy is, as we feel that our privacy has been violated by these new technologies? How can our individual research agendas incorporate and facilitate increased communication? This could be just aspects of educating our students so that they are better able to communicate about security and privacy in the workforce. It could be about making tools, software, or otherwise that help people get a handle on these. It could be about interacting with lawyers and policymakers or with the media. But there are sort of all kinds of ways that we can potentially tackle some of these issues. And also, I think it's important to consider, how can we keep people up to date with the fact that sort of the variables and the coefficients in sort of their personal risk equations are changing all the time? And how can we do that in a way that's not just sort of dumping an essay on them or sort of overloading them? And with that, I would like to pass on to the next presenter.
So I think computers are becoming good metaphors for cars, maybe. That's sad. Oops, sorry, not there. Okay, thanks for having me on this panel, and thanks for that, hopefully not seen as a shameless plug of my research. I didn't plan that video to be played, so thank you for playing that video. And so my talk is going to be related to sensors and privacy, and it's titled, When Electronic Privacy Gets Physical. So I want us to all think about making our research a little more physical, perhaps. So let's think about our personal information, which can be abused in all kinds of ways. And I just picked Dan Solove's taxonomy of privacy. As Tamara said, there's so many different definitions. And Daniel Solove focuses on a taxonomy rather than a definition. And actually, I won't focus much on it other than to say that he categorizes various privacy harms into, he has four categories, like information collection problems, information processing problems, dissemination problems, and invasion. So let's just look concretely at data privacy. And in, speaking of the future of privacy, I don't think anybody here doubts that data privacy is going to be extremely important for many, many years in the age of big data and cloud computing. I won't go through this whole list of research directions that already are promising and people are working on it, but just to give you an idea, on the collection front, you know, there's web tracking and surveillance problems and research to address that. On the processing front, there's data anonymization. On the invasion front, there's, you know, interesting malware research to be done. And in general, where does all this data go? There are good, interesting access control problems. So this is definitely one aspect of the future of privacy. But what keeps me up at night and what I want people to think about a little bit more is that our physical privacy is no longer something that we can take for granted. Okay, so we need to start worrying about it. And why? There are these various types of wearable cameras available on the market. Some of these are available on the market. The one on the top left is called the narrative clip. It's called a life logging device. The one at the bottom in the middle is called the autographer. What they do is you can pin them to your clothing, like your shirt, for example, and they take photos every 30 seconds, all the time, and it's basically logging your day, okay? And CES is occurring, and they just announced the Narrative Clip 2, that has more capabilities. Ion announced SnapCam. A new wearable life logging camera that can now take HD video, right? So this is getting less and less hypothetical. That's my point. Whenever I talk to people about these life logging devices, they, you know, the reaction is, why? Why would anybody do this? This is crazy. I don't understand why people life log to begin with, or if anybody would do it at all. And my response is actually, well, why not? Okay, and what I'm trying to say here is that we are, all of us, okay, we're the oldies, okay, we're the old generation. I'm thinking about my kids, you know, 10 years from now. For them, the question is, why not? Why not TiVo our lives? Basically record everything we're doing. You know, how, you know, this one person mentioned a very interesting paper at the poster session yesterday. I can just rewind and replay that audio clip. Why not, okay? You may not necessarily buy it, by what I'm saying, but maybe in 10 years, this will just become commonplace, maybe. Another reason why life loggers are already buying these devices is to document interesting moments from their lives. And so Autographer, the one company I mentioned, actually has a gallery where people upload interesting photos. Here are some just examples of family photos that may not have been captured with cameras, and travel photos and sports photos. Many of you have probably even heard of the GoPro camera. So the point is that people are seeing value in this and they've started life logging. And you can do much more. We've heard about law enforcement. From the medical perspective, you can think of this as enhanced memory, right? I already gave the example of TiVoing your life. That might be more useful for someone with Alzheimer's, perhaps. You could review your surgery, how it went from your perspective. So the question is, with this new form of collection, how will that change our behavior? Tamara touched upon contextual integrity, right? This Nissenbaum talks about violations of norms from the collection standpoint or the information dissemination standpoint, and both of these are going to occur, right? This form of camera image collection is not something we're used to. We're used to people holding up a phone or a camera and taking the picture, and we don't think about it much, but we're usually aware of when people are photographing us. But now, everyone's wearing these, spy cams in a way, although they're made to be a little more visible. And as we take these cameras into spaces where we might normally not take photos, we now have to start worrying about how we might appear to the external world, depending on where these photos go. Maybe they go to a cloud, who has access to those photos? Maybe you're just streaming your life onto Facebook. And certainly life loggers are interested in that kind of stuff. And so now you're capturing all kinds of photos of you in your private home, where normally you're not taking too many photos. we ran a user study and we saw several photos of people brushing their teeth in front of the mirror, types of photos they would not want to share, say, with their professional circles. So now the question is, not only am I capturing intimate information about myself, the bystanders are extremely worried about being captured by these cameras as well. So now, should I or you, you know, me as the camera wearer or the bystander, do we need to watch what we're eating, what we're watching or who we're watching, what we say? I'm kind of focusing a lot on photos, but you can assume this is video being captured and or audio. Do I have to modulate who I meet, where I go, because my pictures tell a story of who I am? And Goffman has spoken a lot, written a lot about impression management, how we craft our personas for in different settings. Right now I'm presenting my professional persona. I don't know if you want to know what my personal persona is. So let me set up this video. So what I want to do is, just for fun, show you a 10 second or so video of what 2032 might be like if you don't listen to me, okay? So this is Hollywood's take on 1984, okay? It's Sylvester Stallone has been cryogenically unfrozen in 2032 where there's absolutely no crime just because it's a totalitarian society. Nobody can misbehave in any way. No freedom of thought, et cetera, et cetera. But Wesley Snipes' character is out on the loose. The police don't know how to contain him. He's extremely violent, so Sylvester Stallone to the rescue. Sandra Bullock is explaining to him what the future is like, what 2032 is like. And there's some risque language here, warning.
Illegal. Alcohol, caffeine, contact sports, meat.
Are you shitting me?
John Spartan, you are fined one credit for a violation of the verbal morality statute.
What the hell is that?
John Spartan, you are fined one credit.
Bad language, chocolate, gasoline, uneducational toys, and anything spicy.
Okay, so that's the clip. But this may not be that out there, right? So let's come back to 2014. Just a week or two ago, I rented a Hertz car during the holidays, and their never lost GPS navigation system. Can you notice something kind of scary? Let me zoom in. So there's a camera in there. And this was a little shocking to me. And you can dig around on Google trying to find out what this camera is about, and it's hard to find out information about it. The best I could find was what I can amount to hearsay, which is the idea is that you can video chat for customer assistance. In case of law, in case of auto theft, they can turn the camera on and look at what's going on inside the car and such. But these units are showing up in our auto fleets, rental fleets. So that was a little shocking to me. So cameras are showing up everywhere. But again, I have to remind myself as well, this is not all about cameras. Let's go back to the Demolition Man video, right? So phones are always listening to us now. Now you might think, oh, it's all being it's all local processing on hardware, perhaps, and it's not really being leaked off into the cloud. I personally would be quite skeptical of that claim, right? And where we might be headed from here. You could do all kinds of more sophisticated processing in the cloud. So at some point, maybe we're just all streaming audio to the cloud all the time. I don't know. So this scenario that I'm painting, what I'm trying to say is not actually that ridiculous. Put it that way. So now I wanted to mention just quickly some ongoing research on trying to address such problems. So in terms of collection, I was talking to Serge Egelman just a couple of days ago, and he's got recent work that'll come out soon on camera indicators. How do you indicate to people that recording is taking place? Most of the time, people don't know they're being recorded. Although you might want to think about in this life logging scenario, if everyone's recording all the time, we just have to assume that everyone's recording. Then the question is, where are the cameras? So maybe the cameras have to be more visible. There's work on bystanders pushing beacons or signals to people or gestures to cameras saying, you know, please don't record me, and there's interesting work to be done there. Or the cameras themselves can try to recognize sensitive subjects and not record certain sensitive subjects, and we've done some work on that. In terms of processing, along the lines, again, of how should we process these images, how should we detect sensitive situations. So we ran a user study to figure out what do people think is sensitive about imagery collected from such devices. Then there's work on what do you do with such sensitive imagery, and there's a lot of work, and Arvind has some work, the Darkly paper, many of you might be familiar with, some of our work as well. And then all of you might have been thinking about, okay, all this, already been thinking about all this, all these images being uploaded to the cloud, you know, what kind of large-scale face detection might be taking place? You know, you could, maybe the government can call up, you know, all kinds of photos about me without my knowledge, perhaps. And the next interesting question is, well, what about the dissemination of data? And one interesting thing we found out in our user study was that wearers of these devices actually cared about the privacy of bystanders. They said, oh, we don't want to share this photo because it would be embarrassing to this person in the photo. And so there are great opportunities for researching what we're calling, it's a borrowed term, propriety policies. So not only privacy policies about my data, but I might set a propriety policy saying, I'm willing to throw away 20% of my photos if they violate other people's privacy. In life logging, where you're collecting thousands of images per day, you're not actually that emotionally attached to your images. You might be willing to throw away those images. And then the research questions are how to identify those images, for example. So I'm almost done here. So before I conclude, I just wanted to use another quote of Dan Solov's that says, part of what makes society a good place in which to live is the extent to which it allows people freedom from the intrusiveness of others. So far, this has probably been true, but I don't know anymore. But a society without privacy protection would be suffocating, and it might not be a place in which most would want to live. And I agree with that. So how can we make 2032 less suffocating? Well, I actually am not going to give you the answers, and we will all discuss this together. But I'll leave us with some ponderable questions. I just talked about propriety, and do we actually now have to rely on the goodwill of the camera wearers? Some people have suggested DRM-based approaches where I can turn off other people's cameras. That may or may not be a viable approach. Another thing to think about, well, to heck with it all, you know, is this the end of physical privacy? Should we give up and just retreat to our thoughts? But we already saw a video before the previous panel about even our thoughts perhaps not being safe from snooping anymore. So can we all ever have any private thoughts? And then this is the fun one to end with. Where do we draw the line with these cameras? Okay, here's a quote from Steve Mann in one of his workshop papers. Computer vision is embedded in toilets, urinals, hand wash faucets. So, you know, when you go to the restroom next time when you're at the urinal, think about the Delta faucet that might be using a 1024 pixel linear array watching you. Okay, and he claims this is already here. Okay, so I'll leave it at that.
It does it automatically. Cool. Thank you, Apu. That was great. Lots to think about. I think the most interesting privacy domains, perhaps, are the ones where we least understand what the problems even are. So I want to tell you about a couple of those today. I want to start telling you about online tracking in particular and some of the work that we're doing in this area. But I'll also end with a privacy question in a somewhat related but different domain where I think nobody really has any idea how to go about solving the problem, and I'll be very curious to hear your thoughts on that. And by the way, this is webtap.princeton.edu is our URL for all the research that we're doing on this. It stands for the Princeton Web Transparency and Accountability Project, and I encourage you to look up our papers and code and data and everything else that we're putting out there. And this is, I lead a team of grad students and postdocs and undergrads. These are the main grad students. There are a bunch of people involved in this project as well, so all credit to them. So I'll start with something you've probably all seen, which is third-party online tracking, is the idea that sites other than the one you're visiting that are typically invisible are compiling profiles of your browsing history. And these are not aggregates of how many people visited the New York Times, but it's a dossier for every one of you in this room of all the sites that you've visited. And who has access to this information? Oh, well, it's just these guys. Many of you may have seen the slide. It's a famous slide called the Display Advertising Technology Landscape from a company called Luma Partners. And as you can see, it's just an ecosystem of exploding complexity of hidden third parties on web pages, advertisers, demand-side platforms, supply-side platforms, analytics companies, and a lot of those whose roles I don't even understand. I certainly don't claim to be an expert on the economics of that ecosystem, but these are all companies that are in your browser. And in fact, a recent study found that on a top 50 website, on average, there are about 64 independent tracking mechanisms. And our studies confirmed this kind of number as well. So contrast this with a domain like social network privacy, where you might put up some data like a photo to Facebook, but you might still want some control over it, as opposed to a situation like web browsing, where you're just going about your regular browsing. You didn't even know who the actors are who are collecting data, who they're sharing it with, and what use that data is being put to. And you have a similar phenomenon in other domains like shopping mall tracking. This is one of the hottest areas, beacons and other stuff that track you when you're going around a shopping mall based on your phone. And this goes back to the theme of physical tracking that we've been talking about a lot today. But this notion that there's a transparency problem here, where you don't even know who are sort of the adversaries, if you want to use that term, or the data collectors that you're dealing with and what technologies are being used, that is a very fundamental problem. And it's somewhat new to the privacy community that even understanding the privacy problem requires building a lot of tools and infrastructure. But it's an emerging area. A lot of people are starting to do it. And it often goes by the term transparency. That's why we use that term as well. I'll tell you a little bit more about why that's important, what are some of the tools that we've built, and what insights it's yielding. So, but why should you care about third-party tracking, though? Sure, there are a lot of companies tracking this data and various things they're doing with it. Well, one problem is that third-party tracking can be a vector for malware. It slows down page rendering. It can be used for a lot of things like price discrimination and behavioral targeting, which really makes people uncomfortable. But also, it turns out the NSA is using third-party advertising tracking cookies for doing their surveillance. This turns out to be a much better identifier of your browsing than what you can infer by looking at network wiretaps and whatnot. And we have a paper investigating how they might be going about doing this. So again, all of this is available from webtap.princeton.edu. But one of the cool things, part of the good news about domains where we don't really understand what's going on, is that every time someone does do a study that reveals some of this previously hidden tracking, just the act of revealing it ends up having a pretty enormous positive effect. And perhaps the best example of this is a series of news articles that the Wall Street Journal ran between 2010 and 2012 called What They Know. And it's just a phenomenal series. It was, I believe, a runner-up for the Pulitzer Prize, or maybe even a winner, I forget. And it, from a computer science perspective, the online tracking and even physical tracking, as you can see in that picture, the problems that they revealed, just birthed a whole subfield of research within the privacy community on transparency technologies and not just privacy technologies. So even reverse engineering the type of tracking that's going on and who's collecting your data and so on. So this had a phenomenal impact. And I like to call this the unreasonable effectiveness of measurement. And the work that we're doing is really at the intersection of traditional measurement work, internet and web measurement, and online privacy. So measurement has had a huge impact on online privacy. There are different ways to think about it. If you want to take an economic perspective, there's what people call an information asymmetry, where the consumer or the user or the browser or you don't really know what's going on, what's happening to your data, how that's being used for commerce, whereas the party on the other side of that transaction, if you want to call it that, has a lot of information about that process. That leads to an information asymmetry, and measurement studies help break this information asymmetry. It also leads to a more informed public debate, and in cases of more egregious violations of online privacy expectations, you can imagine regulation and enforcement. So our starting point as computer scientists for the work that we wanted to do, we're not journalists, right, is what if oversight of online tracking and personalization can in fact be automated? What if you can do this at scale? What if you can do this on a web scale instead of humans investigating the practices of one or two websites? How far can you go with that? So we set out to build that infrastructure. And let me give you a quick example of something that we were able to measure using this infrastructure, and then I'll come back to the actual tool that we built. So what we set out to measure was something called canvas fingerprinting. Some of you may have seen this. By the way, if you have not seen it, if you look at the slide, it might look like I messed up my slides and there's something weird going on there. But that's not actually true. This is, in fact, what goes on in your browser. So what is going on here is that you visit a web page, and the website is trying to get a unique fingerprint of your device. So how do they do that? They use, or maybe you can say abuse, the HTML5 canvas element. So this couldn't even have been done a few years ago. And what they do is they draw an invisible image on the screen that looks like that. You don't see it, but this happens dozens of times per day, or at least was until our study, and I'll tell you a bit more about that, when you browse the web. And this is drawn to your browser. And why does this help? If you look at that sentence, if you can make out the words, you'll see something weird about that. What's happening there, it uses all the letters of the alphabet. It's one of those sentences like, a quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. And the reason it's doing all this is that it tries to draw an image, render some text and some other stuff on the screen, and then read that PNG image back pixel by pixel and compute a hash of it. And this turns out to be a fingerprint that's somewhat unique of your device. And the reason for that is that the way that the image is rendered on the screen depends upon your browser version, JavaScript engine, but also your operating system, underlying CPU, graphics hardware, and so on. Right. So that gives them several bits of entropy, and if they combine that with other types of fingerprinting, they can develop a unique fingerprint of everybody who they see online, and this acts as a very sticky identifier, which it's very hard to defend yourself against. And you might see a citation there at the bottom. So this was actually a paper by Hovav and his student just a couple of years ago, and it turned out that in just 2 years it had gone from this research paper to some guy in Russia putting out some code on GitHub to some startups experimenting with this. Two, when we did the study earlier this year, this was in January-ish of 2014, last year actually, there's a collaboration between KU Lviv and Claudia Diaz's team and my team here at Princeton. We found that when we did a web-wide crawl of the top 100,000 websites, it was used on over 5% of those sites, over 5,500 sites, by 20 different providers. Right. The computer science challenge here is, of course, looking at a piece of JavaScript, analyzing its behavior, and determining if it is, in fact, doing canvas fingerprinting or if it's some more innocuous use of the Canvas API. And so in our paper, we have details of how we were able to do this with zero false positives across a 100,000 site study. When we actually ran a million site crawl, we do have a few false positives there, and we're working on getting that rate down. So fundamentally, the innovation here in this and other similar studies that we've done is take something that would have required, say, a team of journalists doing a manual investigation of the practices of some entity that people are very uncomfortable with, and being able to automate that, maybe use machine learning, and you'll see what some of the automation challenges are in our paper, and be able to do that on a web-wide scale and treat that as a big data problem. So one of the things that took us by surprise after we did the study is that actually the press got wind of this, and when they did that story, there were something like 10,000 tweets. The story went viral because people were very upset about all of this happening on their browsers, and in particular, there were something like several hundred tweets by people who were running websites saying, I had no idea that this third party was sitting on my site and doing all this. I'm very upset about this. I'm going to remove this third party. There was one particular third party that was, in fact, doing this on the majority of these sites. And they had to bow to the public backlash, and they stepped back and said, okay, we're going to stop doing this. So immediately, and this is one of the cases where just the act of measurement had a big positive impact. This doesn't happen nearly so much anymore on your browsers when you browse the web. But you know, we want to go farther than that. Sometimes measurement itself is enough. But also, we were able to provide this data to developers of browser privacy tools like Ghostry and EFF and so on. And also, people wrote some specific blocking tools in response to our study that can be used to block Canvas and other types of fingerprinting. So we're treating this as a pipeline to collect data and use machine learning and feed that into blocking tools in order to develop defense mechanisms against online tracking in a much more sophisticated fashion. So again, this is our site WebTap, and these are the main grad students who worked on this. I'll very quickly tell you about what is the architecture that we use for these web scale measurement studies. Fundamentally, we have a Firefox instance, an automated Firefox instance that's browsing the web, and what that sort of wiretap is depicting is we use MittenProxy and other proxy tools in order to basically wiretap ourselves and collect and analyze all the data that's passing between websites and the browser. But that's not enough. We have an analysis infrastructure sitting on top of this that can do all kinds of sophisticated analyses of what a particular piece of script, for example, might be doing. We also use a tool called Selenium, and we have two layers of wrappers around it in order to really make it behave like a realistic human user. And we put a lot of effort into this in getting the automated browser to really behave like a real person. And we vary that. We make it behave like a typical affluent user by visiting websites that we know to be popular among affluent consumers versus a poor consumer and so on. And so that's how we do our studies. So here's sort of my big picture view of this third-party tracking problem, which I think is a really serious problem. But I want to claim that it's where it is today is similar to where spam was 10 years ago. And this approach that we're using and similar approaches that people are using, treating this as a problem that can be solved using these large data sets plus machine learning and shipping those classifiers or block lists out to browsers, I think is going to have a huge impact on this problem. It's never going to be 100%, just like with spam today, even though we've controlled the problem to a great degree. There is some understanding that an email that you send might be caught by someone's spam filter, right? And I think there will be a period of social adjustment. So this is still a big challenge, but I think I have some confidence that this approach is really going to work to put a big dent in this problem. But here's the problem looking beyond online tracking a little bit that I think in the community we have no idea how to go about this. By the way, I also want to give a shout out to others who are working on similar things in online transparency. Roxana's group has built this great tool called X-Ray. Nick Feemster has also been working on a tool called Bobble to expose search personalization and so on. And many others who are doing this as well. Nick and Roxana are both here. All awesome stuff. But the limitation of all of these approaches, including ours that I've talked about, is that it's limited to measuring things on the web. But the problem is quickly getting beyond that, and we saw repeatedly this notion of physical privacy being a big problem. But it becomes even more compelling and harder to solve when you put those two together, and that's what's increasingly happening. Let me tell you what is this problem that I have in mind. So I've been going to the Privacy Law Scholars Conference for the last 6 years. I have to say it's one of my favorite conferences. I try not to miss it every year, and I would encourage you to go as well. And Privacy Law Scholars, and some of you who go there can back me up on this as well, have much more of a pulse on what are the privacy problems that people might care about out there than computer scientists do at times. And here's the problem that they're all worried about. The problem that they're all worried about is that there are all these entities collecting our data, and we're stepping into what people like to call algorithmic society, where you have a user, and their data is being collected not just from online tracking, but also physical tracking in stores, just beacons tracking their location, their housing records, medical records, all of that, basically combining into one database in the sky. And the problem comes when there is a big machine learning system that uses all of that personal data to make decisions about that user, whether it's price discrimination or it's even political email campaign targeting, and it's what products to recommend to them, what offers to give to them, and so on. So people are extremely creeped out by this notion that our personal data is being fed into algorithmic society to make decisions about us. And when you go to places like the Privacy Law Scholars Conference, the number of papers talking about this kind of problem has shot up from zero to about one-third of all papers there in just 2 or 3 years. And when they talk to computer scientists, this is one of the things they're desperate to have an answer to, for technologists to go and reverse engineer the system and tell us what's inside that black box, what are the attributes that are being used for this personalization and targeting. Is my race being used? Is this based on gender, my income? If we outlaw these specific variables, are they just going to move to a proxy for one of these variables, right? A machine learning system that doesn't directly use it but can be equally effective. And there are many examples of this emerging, but I think the challenge for computer scientists is to generalize the privacy problem a little bit, both online and offline, as well as treat it as a reverse engineering problem, and then use that as a basis to see how to go about solving that problem using a combination of technology and policy and social solutions. So I'll leave you with these questions to ponder, which actually combines the wonderful ones that Apu had with a couple of the ones at the end that I added on to it as well. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on all of these questions. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have some ideas up here, and if people are ready with questions, feel free to come on up, and if not, I will. Well, I see somebody coming up. Otherwise, I will drop a bomb on people. So, but go ahead.
All right, Cami Vanier, Indiana University. We heard earlier this concept that privacy has a lot to do with my ability to represent myself or misrepresent myself if I so choose. And we see things like online dating sites, people specifically altering the way they are representing themselves to the system in an effort to get better matches depending on your view of that situation. How do you think that that's actually going to impact some of these algorithms and learning and various things where people will start trying to represent themselves in a way other than that they are in order to manipulate the way the system is functioning? And how that will impact some of these automated decisions that are happening and cause impact on others because it is machine learning and they're learning from this wrong data.
That's a great question. Let me perhaps start by giving another example of a way in which people have been doing this. People are organizing cookie swapping infrastructures where people can take their tracking cookies from their browser and upload it to the central repository, and they can exchange each other's cookies and experience the web as someone else would experience it. So I think it's a great social plus technological experiment. I think those efforts are still in their early stages. In terms of really thinking deeply about this and developing a theory of this, Helen Nissenbaum, again, has been doing some great work, because her name has already been brought up on this panel. She calls this obfuscation, and she uses the term, as a non-computer scientist, in a very different way than in the security community we're used to the term obfuscation. But she acknowledges that it's not intended to be foolproof against an adversary who's really trying to come after you, but she says that obfuscation has a really important place in privacy protection. I think that's a fascinating claim. It's somewhat counter to how we're used to thinking about things in the security community. I don't know if an arms race of obfuscation versus companies trying to undo our obfuscation would be good for anybody, but I think it would be good to come up with some norms of what levels of obfuscation are acceptable, and maybe to have widely available tools for doing that within those acceptable levels that we have normatively decided upon.
So to add to that, I'd say it's an interesting thing to think about, and it's not necessarily bad. I mean, it's not necessarily good either, but it's not necessarily bad. It's sort of, some aspects of that are already things that we're running into in terms of, for example, some of these big data repository companies have data that they think is correct that may not necessarily be correct in the user's eyes. And maybe it's because it's factually incorrect and you can say, with certainty, I think that the user has the right to change this to the correct thing. Or maybe it's just a matter of interpretation. And then you get into questions of sort of who owns that data, philosophically. So it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that, and I was just thinking that, there's some very interesting ethical considerations. It would have been great for the ethics panel about, of us crafting our persona maybe in a way that doesn't match our existing persona. And I was, again, thinking back to all this imagery that we're collecting, and I'm working with a computer vision professor on analyzing this data, and you could have tools that said, I want to look like, I don't know, a cool something, I'm single, whatever, and just completely misrepresent myself, selectively pick out those photos from my life logs that tell a very different story. By leaving out certain images and by curating your own images carefully, you can create personas that don't match your own. I think it's interesting in terms of privacy to foil the trackers in some way, but it raises just interesting ethical concerns, and so I think this is great, something to look at in the future.
Isn't that what Facebook already is about? You could do that on Facebook if you want.
I think that's a very good point, yeah, and I do it myself.
although, just as an interesting counterpoint to this, Does this, ubiquitous data collection, ubiquitous physical tracking, does that mean in order to fake our persona, we actually have to become who we want to be? Is this a bad thing?
I guess there's also a subtle little bit in there about if I drop this data in here in order to cause an effect I want on my shopping site, where does it pop back up again? And how obvious that is?
Subhash Garg, Oklahoma State. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Perhaps looking back can tell us a lot about how things are going to be in the future. Apu spoke about life log. We had diaries like James Joyce or Proust, who cataloged every moment of the day. And what it did was it created a big shock. They became very famous. But then after some time, other people who tried to emulate them did not generate the same interest. So one thing that is happening, and that's the point that was made by one of you, is that how technology is used to deal with these issues itself changes the behavior of the people. And some of these things may not remain all that significant. In other words, the amount of importance we give to the logs, it might become passé, it might become too boring, you know. It doesn't really matter, or we don't give value to sites which are cataloging this information. The other point related to fake identities, well, that's been a part of human nature for centuries. People used to wear expensive suits or dresses in order to build up a certain identity. You know, part of the reason why people wanted a lot of money was to be able to create fake identity, because one didn't really know who the person was behind the dress or the suit that a person had worn. Now, there's another point, apart from this, there's another point I want to make, and this is in relation to what the future may be like. I think that since clearly cybersecurity has an aspect which is related to society, perhaps one also needs to do some or guess as to where the future might be going. And a lot of scholars have suggested that the future with increasing automation, with self-driven cars, with robots doing all that needs to be done, would be one where there would be fewer and fewer people wanting to have children. Perhaps the population would shrink. And Pareto principle, 20% of the people do 80% of the work, 4% of the people do 64% of the work. So a lot of people won't have any jobs. So possibly they would be maybe doing life logs of themselves and tracking everybody else's life log, and the government or the state would have to provide doles so that all of these people would be able to live. This could be one of those dystopias that could be the future.
Thanks. Yeah, that's very interesting. And I do worry about the dystopia. Maybe most of us think that, yeah, this is very unlikely, and it probably is, but it does worry me and motivate my research. But I thought you said something very interesting about all these life logs or whatever data we're collecting, audio, could just become so passe and boring. And I had a conversation with somebody, and unfortunately it was long enough ago, I don't remember who it was, but they said actually this kind of life logging could not result in boring data, but or just boring people. You might actually have a bunch of depressed people. And what this person was trying to saying was that our brain naturally forgets a lot. If we remembered everything, we would all be just depressed and moping all the time. So we have a human brain has this great ability of forgetting a lot, forgetting the past. And so we might want to think about this aspect of forgetting the past. I know people have already addressed this issue in the talked about this issue in the context of Facebook and social media, the right to be forgotten. I mean, having data being erased at certain points and so on, and how can this data expire? So I think this aspect is very important, that we probably don't want to log everything. And you know, maybe we life-logged when we were kids and captured all kinds of stuff, and we don't want to drag that into our adult lives, so we need to be able to forget some of these things that we're cataloging about ourselves.
So I want to jump in with a couple points related to that. One, you were commenting about the depression aspect, and there are already studies showing some of those effects because we have this impression management and on social media, yes, there is some of sort of reaching out and sharing, you know, common woes. So you have more people blogging about, you know, the problems they have going through cancer treatment or things, and that is, you know, an aspect about sharing sharing problems. But of course, there are a lot of people that are focusing really on the impression management, and they only share the really great things, and they put themselves in a really great light. And there are definitely measurements of effects socially where people say, well, look, all my peers from college, from high school, they're all doing fantastic. Their life is wonderful. Nothing goes wrong. So we already are running into some of that. And for example, if you look at teens and social development of teens, and if you haven't seen the work of Dana Boyd, she has some really interesting things with that and social media. And I wanted to add on to the discussion of this forgetting. So you were bringing up particularly in the aspect of maybe for life logging, you want to forget some things. And we're already seeing that some people use things like Snapchat. So there was, for example, a paper doing a sort of a semi-open-ended survey in that was presented in Financial Crypto last year. And not everyone is using it for the, you know, so-called sexting or whatever. Some people just like the transient nature of it, and they value that they don't, you know, have this long cluttered repository of images. Let's see, another thought, but I'll let you jump on in there while I remember it.
I was just, this idea of wanting to edit our life log, but obviously it's too big, we don't have time to manually edit it. And I'm just wondering about the software that's going to go through and edit our life log so that when we look at it, it makes us happy.
Oh, so I want to jump in there actually with sort of commentary on algorithms and how they can sort of unintentionally cause side effects. So for example, if you have an algorithm editing your life log and it's, you know, preserving this certain subjective history of what your life was like.
Happy cats,
all right. But that has sort of deep effects that maybe the original technology creators didn't consider. So if you have not run across some of the articles, there are lots of instances apparently of, so Google has this thing where it'll automatically do like, this was your year, and it will make you a slideshow. Well, one article in particular I was reading this year, the author's he had a young daughter, a child, and the whole year was about sort of her dying. And of course, there are many reasons why algorithms might pull things in. Some have to do with maybe the prominence of the picture, maybe people star it or like it. And there are many reasons to star or like things, including this was important, not I really liked it. So then you have an algorithm that's saying, you know, with some happy music showing you a slideshow being like, your daughter died this year, which of course has sort of deep emotional impacts for people potentially. Similarly, when you get into questions of things like algorithms that are tailoring you with personalized content, sort of what is the effect of knowing that sort of maybe a personalized ad is personalized rather than a generic ad? What if you are getting sort of wedding advertisements on Hulu and you just, you know, broke off your engagement? What is the psychological effect of knowing it's tailored rather than just some generic ad? Interesting to think. The article was using the term sort of inadvertent algorithmic cruelty.
I had a thought related to the algorithm. So when I read about that example on Facebook, I was also wondering, you know, can these algorithms use input from the crowd? So various people on your timeline might be reading this. Of course, in this example, it wasn't posted without your consent, but you could ask people to say, you know, does this look appropriate or not? Get some signals from people, and then tailor, and then maybe the algorithms can do better. I just see this as an interesting research area, just socio-computational system. But anyway, I don't know who was next. Sorry.
David Coates, Dartmouth. Actually, my Facebook-generated year-end summary led with a gravestone. Fortunately, not of one of my children. It was my cat who passed away this year. But I was amused by this mistake, I think, in their algorithm in choosing a gravestone as the summary of my year. I wondered what that meant about me. But I have a different question. Actually, I'm coming back to the first question I think that was asked in the first Q&A of the first lecture in this workshop yesterday after LaTanya Sweeney's talk. Carl Landwehr asked about the definition of privacy and the tension between at least two versions of that. One is that it's about control and it's about the individual's ability to or right to control information about themselves and its dissemination versus, you know, Helen Nissenbaum again, contextual privacy and this notion that it's really about the system or the recipients of the data following norms and, you know, treating their data respectfully. And I'm actually more confused than ever after watching your presentations as to whether either of those is even feasible. Certainly when the data is being collected by web trackers or cameras, I don't have control, and it seems there's some technical approaches to give me some control, but I'm not optimistic that those will succeed pervasively. So how should we be thinking about privacy? Is there a definition of privacy? Is, as Tamara suggested in her slides, the definition of privacy itself changing? I'm really not quite sure how to think about this.
So the reason why I picked Dan Solove's taxonomy, and if you haven't read that, I highly recommend reading that that paper, that article. To summarize my understanding of his argument, he says, yeah, he goes through all the various definitions of privacy, and he says the problem is that all these folks are trying to crystallize privacy into some how many ever sentence italicized definition. And you can't do that. It's a porous concept. What we can do is instead try to create a taxonomy, and when we have a new problem, see if it bears resemblance. And he talks about how humans learn by example. We don't teach children definitions of the world. You know, a chair is defined as this. You look at several chairs, and a new chair, you know, it's a classification. Now, this is a chair because it resembles other chairs. So that's what he's trying to say. I'm going to create, this is the best taxonomy I could come up with for now, and now in their future problems, they probably resemble one of these and probably be a privacy issue. And he cites some judge who said it's popular, and how do you know if this image is porn? He's like, when I see it, I know it's porn. It's hard to define it, but you know it when you see it. Right, and so that's kind of what this paper's angle is, not necessarily the correct angle or the perfect angle, but that's why I particularly like this definition. But I think Tammy is more of the expert here, so I'll turn it over.
Oh, I'd hardly say that, but I think it's a pity, actually, that we didn't end up having the keynote from Deirdre Mulligan. So I don't know what talk she would have given, but I've seen a talk from her before where one of the things that she highlighted was that privacy is a contested term. That part of its value is that nobody really agrees on what it is, so we keep arguing about it. And I'm probably, you know, misrepresenting how she would have put it, but the general idea. And to add on to that, maybe the value of looking at all these different, you know, definitions and theories, none of which maybe perhaps quite fit the exact problem you're looking at, is you can sort of take some of these abstract ideas and try to distill them down into maybe different technical ways you might choose to approach a privacy-respecting technology or a privacy-enhancing technology, where you start to wonder about sort of different ways, you know, is it push or pull? Is it compliance-based, you know, compliance-dependent or compliance-independent? Is it, you know, enforced or is it suggested? You were mentioning the DRM enforcing of, you know, cameras and people not being able to use it. Well, if you think that sort of if you take an approach that someone's fundamental right to have, you know, preserved memories, then maybe you want to think that things should be suggested but not enforced. You know, when you can take these different high-level theories and use them as inspiration for different technical mechanisms to explore that you might not have otherwise, you know, had in mind.
I just want to jump in with a quick plus one for Dan Solove's paper that Abu mentioned. I thought your explanation of it was quite good. And I really recommend reading this paper, and let me explain why with an analogy. Often in technical fields, math, theoretical computer science, we're used to this phenomenon where everybody is trying to solve some problem, and it's going nowhere, and nobody understands why, and then somebody comes in out of left field with an impossibility result. Right? Dan Tsolov's paper is the closest thing I've seen to an impossibility result in a non-technical field. It's simply an intellectual tour de force, and it just demolishes the idea, like you said, I think, that you can have one definition or one theory of privacy that's going to apply in all of these scenarios. And Dan's taxonomy itself has 16 different elements, so inherently, any workable definition of privacy that you want to apply everywhere is going to have sort of a linear growth complexity with the complexity of the world that you were talking about. And I think that's something we just have to get used to. But I think what's been a lot more successful is coming up with an operational or technical definition of a subset of privacy for some particular domain you're interested in looking at. And so I think that's a more fruitful question to ask, perhaps.
Just whatever, operational definition you're using, you should, include it in the results.
Good point.
Hey, Jason Hong from Carnegie Mellon. Just a quick comment for my favorite definition of privacy is you know it when you lose it. My comment is a little bit more to follow up with one of the comments you made, Arvind, about developers of these websites not knowing that these third parties were the ones that were violating the privacy. And I think that's a really fascinating point because we've seen the same thing in our research with smartphone apps, that a lot of these smartphone apps, the apps themselves aren't violating privacy. It's really the third-party libraries that are trying to collect all this data and then using it for advertising. And the follow-up that I think is really interesting is we actually surveyed and interviewed a whole bunch of developers, and they didn't even realize that this was going on. And to make it even worse, they had very low awareness of what they should be doing at all in terms of best practices, as well as what the laws were in California with respect to apps, as well as the Federal Trade Commission guidelines. And I think this is a really big problem because if you look at cybersecurity in general, I feel like we do have a good set of best practices for web engineering. You should hash the passwords, use SSL, so on. But for best practices, we don't even have a good definition of privacy, and on top of it, we don't even have good best practices as to what we should be doing. I think that's a really big cause of a lot of the kinds of challenges that we're seeing. So, if we're collecting all this data, well, do we apply the fair information practices? Do we apply this? Do we apply that? We don't even know. And so I think this is a really big challenge for our community in terms of what we should be doing, and if we could figure this out, maybe we could develop better tools for developers, better education, better ways of detecting these kinds of problems as well too. So this is just a little bit more of a food for thought rather than a question. But if we do want to disseminate all the results of the research that out of our community, I think we should think about developers as one of the major kinds of outputs.
Thank you. That's a great point. I can tell you a little bit about a tool we're starting to develop in that direction, which is a tool that a website owner themselves would use that generates a sort of a third-party threat profile of that website for their own consumption. And this is remarkably something that doesn't exist yet because websites have become so complex and there are these chains of third parties, one embedding another, that the developer themselves doesn't know what's going on their own site. So you need technology to help them figure out what's going on their own website. And your point is slightly different, that we need norms and best practices and definitions and so on. But I think the tools and the definitions can work together. So we're trying to tackle one side of that equation.
Yeah, one more quick follow-up, too, is I think we also have to be very careful as we're trying to analyze, the smartphone apps and websites and so on, because we are getting them for free, for some epsilon of free, but at the same time, they're collecting all this data about us. And so we have to be careful not to destroy this ecosystem, but we also have to make sure that privacy is being preserved. And I think that's also another really big fundamental challenge that really has been addressed here, which is, if we're getting all this stuff for free, who's going to pay for it?
And I definitely agree with your point about sort of giving developers better tools and better knowledge in order to tackle some of these issues. So, for example, I've been particularly interested in different sort of brainstorming tools that we can give either users or developers or managers in order to get sort of a better grasp on the space that they're working in. Yeah, for example, when I was at the University of Washington, we went ahead and put together a deck of physical brainstorming cards along the line of some of like the IDEO method cards, some of these other kinds of tools, to help them sort of take a very high-level view and think outside the box about threats that might be posed to or by a technological system. So it was very security-based, although it had an aspect of sort of human impact harm, but definitely sort of tools don't have to just be particularly technological in nature if they sort of give people the ability to tackle things hands-on.
So when you talk about these ubiquitous recording life logging devices, I'd like to get the thoughts from the panel what the right threat model is for thinking about those. Because lots of the solutions that came up, and I think they make sense only in the scenario where the owner of the device is cooperating. And I'm not sure, you know, maybe that's the only threat model that makes sense for this. That doesn't seem a very satisfying one from the perspective of someone that's worried about someone hiding a recording device or going to the trouble of taking out the LED that's supposed to light up when it's recording or doing things to the device. So I'm wondering, is there some threat model that is stronger than the owner of the device is totally cooperative and buys a legal device that has all these properties that should, or are we basically giving up against any kind of malicious tracking?
So this may seem obvious, but I'm going to argue that the solution to a lot of these problems is part technical and part social and part legal. That being said, there are some specific cases where if you are really enthusiastic about your defenses, you can go ahead and either create or try to work with defenses that are technological based or physical based that sort of protect you without relying on compliance. So you have some of these art projects that are sort of a ring of LEDs or whatever around your face to try to obscure cameras. You have similarly some work that looks at, you know, installing some of them in physical spaces and tracking cameras and blinding them. You know, you can talk
so,
about...
So we should all wear masks.
So we should all wear masks, right? You have, you know, paint art projects looking at different ways that you can use face paint to obscure yourself from specific, you know, facial identification systems and algorithms. So depending on where your particular values lie, you can, there are some cases where you can take a more proactive defense against things that don't rely on compliance. But I think for many people, the solution will lie somewhere in the compromise between technical and social and legal, and some people will end up falling through the cracks, and you know, you hope you're not one of those people.
So you do envision regulations that would make it illegal to sell a device that records without some clear indication?
Potentially. I mean, so some aspects of law judgment already take into account how sort of obvious a camera is, because that plays into whether or not, you know, a reasonable person expects to be recorded. So potentially, yes.
Yeah, I think this is a great question. I probably focused on one particular aspect in my slides. But I personally have also been very interested in the malware threat. So, you know, we call it sensory malware, malware that has sensors. So so your phones or these devices could be listening to you, and some malware could be shipping this data off to some, you know, unknown site. And those are really hard threats to counter. So let's say everyone's life logging, or a large fraction of the population's life logging. Yes, there'll be some fraction of them that are using a device that are compromised, and you know, so you're going to have to watch. There's some baseline. You're going to have to be aware of that general threat. But what I find also very interesting is just the social fabric. You know, a lot of this data is going to be shared with your social networks, and there's so much opportunity to, for things to go wrong just within that setting. And one of the thoughts I had that I just jotted down is that I feel nowadays our reputation is a high stakes game for our reputation. So, for example, on Facebook, everybody I know. Well, who's on Facebook, I'm connected to them, right? And one photo of me naked, right, when I walk into the bathroom with this life-logging device in front of the mirror, just kill my reputation, at least from my own perspective, right? Some people have no problem with nudity. So I just feel like that in terms of the threat model, I think our social network, just being so connected, that there are opportunities to just focus on, not just, but there are great opportunities focusing on just that aspect where there are no malicious actors, just mistakes happen, and how can we prevent that from happening so that our privacy and reputation is just completely ruined, right? That's something that keeps me up at night, you know?
I'll add a couple of anecdotes to that, pretty much in line with what people have already said. One point I'll make is that I think we should be careful about purely technological solutions to primarily social problems. And a great historical example that I like to give is that apparently when the X-ray machine was invented, Victorian England went into a period of paranoia. And modest women would go into baths fully clothed because they were terrified that there were peeping Toms on every street corner standing there with X-ray machines in their hands trying to peer through walls. Right. So, I mean, these privacy infringing technologies in public have long been available. Sure, technology has changed the equation a little bit, but the fundamental problems have been the same for a long time. And of course, that X-ray machine threat model never really materialized, not because it's technologically infeasible, but because our social defenses in modern societies are so strong, it would be a pretty stupid thing to do. And again, yes, I acknowledge that technology has changed the equation. It's easier to do it more unobtrusively now, but I think there can be defenses that work with, like Apu said, the social fabric that we already have instead of a purely technological solution. You asked if regulation could play a role in making it illegal to sell devices that can record without some visible notification. I believe that that is already the case in Japan. You can't sell smartphones whose cameras don't make an audible click because of their epidemic of upscaled pictures. And I think we have already reacted in that manner. And again, it's a combination of a technological and a social solution. You're not preventing someone from taking a picture, but you're making it apparent that they did, so that the social norms that we do have can come into play in that scenario. So I think that's a good way to approach it.
But I think I agree with you absolutely that, all the solutions aren't necessarily technical. That doesn't mean that we should, necessarily just shrug and say, social and legal will solve it. There are, of course, different design decisions you can make that sort of support current or projected social mechanisms for dealing with some of these problems.
So maybe I'll take a slightly macro view. Every time, you are in an academic conference talking about privacy, it usually leaves you a little bit depressed. But I actually have a pretty optimistic view about it, and maybe I'm being naive. So just to put some perspective, I'm not an economic historian, but I think intuitively I feel that all the technology revolutions that have come about, railroads, computing, telephone, mobile phones, internet, they all have increased the productivity tremendously and improved our quality of life. They all probably brought significant opportunities for fraud, both by the consumers as well as by the firms. So all the technologies brought opportunities for consumers to, create all kind of, fraudulent or commit fraud and firms as well. And probably privacy is somewhat similar, in a similar vein. The technology has given the firms an opportunity to rent seeking by doing all kind of things. But I think, just like in the past, I think we come up with some equilibrium, where we have minimized the frauds. Doesn't mean that we have eliminated. I think the firms still exercise price discrimination. They still keep, abusing their power in various industries. But what I'm saying is that the benefit that the technology has brought about generally has been extremely positive and generated a tremendous amount of surplus. So is it fair to say that if you look 20 years down the line, would privacy be an issue? Yes. People like you and others will keep fighting it at some level. Technology, policy, social norms will hopefully keep the losses coming from them somewhat contained, and the gains would be actually pretty tremendous. So is it fair to feel that technology revolution is all going to be more or less net positive for most of us? Some of us will probably suffer, but I don't know.
I think so, yes. I mean, maybe we're preaching to the choir. Like, we wouldn't be doing privacy research if we were depressed. We have to be excited about the privacy problems. And usually privacy problems exist if the technology has to exist for some reason. We have to have cameras around. We can't put signs everywhere saying no cameras. So now that we have to have cameras, because there's so many interesting applications of it, which are exciting, now we have to think about the privacy concerns, and then somehow technologically, sociologically, ethically, legally, economically, solve this problem. So I feel like it's just exciting, and personally, I'm excited about life logging. I'm scared to wear these devices, but I do wear these occasionally, like when I go and travel and such, because I really see, I personally see the positive value, and enough people are seeing positive values, with such devices. So I don't think any of us are trying to say this is like a doomsday call. It's just the changing face of privacy. That was a working title for this panel at some point. So it's just the changing face, and how do we, what are the new research challenges in this space?
Oh, pretty much, exactly like that. I think we're all gonna be okay. Well, as you were mentioning, some of us are going to fall through the cracks and get burned along the way, and some of us aren't going to like things and are going to try to, you know, build themselves a little, you know, bubble away from certain kinds of technologies. And partly we're going to be okay because our expectations will change. And partly we're going to be okay because of the ecosystem factor that you were bringing up that sort of will, as we move along and morph, will various, you know, the trajectory will change to accommodate certain pressures on the ecosystem. And then partly we'll be okay because along the way there are going to be a lot of people shouting about privacy and pushing the trajectory. But it'll be okay.
Good.
Yeah, the kids are going to be okay. That could have been the alternate title of the panel. Yeah, I don't think any of us disagrees with you. You're absolutely right that technologies are definitely going to be a net positive overall. But we can point to examples where a technological revolution that should have happened either didn't happen or took much longer because not enough attention was paid to the privacy issues. And I think among things that are going on now, Google Glass would probably be a perfect example. There was so much excitement about it a couple of years ago, and I think the reason it's not mainstream technology today is in large part because they did not manage to solve or even address really the privacy issues, and fits very well into the theme of the panel and life-logging technologies and so on. So, you know, why not work together with developers of technology to transition them into society in a manner that's much more acceptable to people and equitable and respects their expectations and so on.
Thanks. So I think we see the stories of, you know, the technology changes and our response to it lags, and especially a few of the early adopters get burned by information leakages that they didn't anticipate. And then we, the rest of us, learn from that experience. So sometimes we even need those people who get hurt by the technology. So in terms of social risk management, is there a role for insurance? Is there a way for us to go back and help those people who have been the guinea pigs and suffered the privacy harm so that we can all learn to manage our privacy and technology better?
If we're talking about actual sort of money insurance rather than sort of the concept of insurance, I would comment that we haven't really figured out cybersecurity insurance yet, so. Not sure about that, but no, it's interesting to think about how, well, for example, we might consider other kinds of measures that might sort of support or compensate people who have been hurt by technologies as early adopters.
This is just making me think back to my example of a reputation with naked photo going off on Facebook, and what kind of, and not talking about dollars or euros or whatever, you know, what kind of social insurance can we have? Is there some kind of social capital I get back? I don't know how you get social capital back in some of these instances, like the example I gave. But yeah, it would be very nice if people saved me from the embarrassment of myself when I start experimenting with life-logging technologies. So that's a fascinating question. I don't know how you do that, and maybe this is interesting research for sociologists, psychologists, I don't know. But it's just a fascinating thought.
So in part it's being saved from other people's life blogging experiments because you're caught on their cameras. But there was a sense in some of the comments a while back that if everybody is capturing all these images, that any particular person is sort of lost in all the data. And you had to comment, oh, we'll all be okay, but you know, maybe a few people fall through the cracks. But of course, a given person is okay only so long as nobody's actually interested in that person particularly, whether mm-hmm. for government or legal or social reasons, you know, revenge reasons or so forth. And then if somebody is interested in you particularly, then there's all that data to be sifted and creatively crafted for whatever purpose. And that hasn't come up in the thread of discussion so far, but any comments?
So in our panel yesterday on social networks and crowdsourcing, we had a fascinating discussion along these lines where one of the members said, you know, in a future society, maybe a future society where there's absolute complete transparency, you know the people's thoughts, you have recordings of everything, you know everything about everybody, your life is an open book. That might actually be a great society to live in. And then the discussion quickly went around to whether that is even possible. So let's say your life is an open book and everybody's life is an open book. Now you're going to have petabytes or whatever is beyond petabytes, tons of data about even an individual person. So even if you turn your attention to the individual person, right, you're going out on a date with somebody, you want to look them up, how are you going to find the five big embarrassing events or really, you know, events that tell you something about who this person is that that would turn you away from that person? How are you going to find that even in this transparent log, even, you know, with all the tools at your disposal? You don't know what you're looking for, right? So what kind of algorithms would you use? So the discussion was more about, actually, you know, even in that society, maybe we do have quite a bit of privacy, and now it maybe, and it probably relates to, you know, the data mining algorithms, what it can dig up about us. So we will still have some privacy. It just depends on what you can dig up about the person. So I'll just leave it at that. But it was a fun discussion.
And sort of along those lines, so some of the answers or comments have been centered on, you know, well, things that not technologists can do, but what about concentrating on, if we have all these sort of automated ways to make decisions about people, so this also relates to sort of the discrimination and the redlining, maybe what one thing technologists can do is really foreground the uncertainty or the assumptions that are being made. So that sort of builds in maybe the understanding that when you get this kind of result out, yes, it's a result that the algorithm is giving you, but it's, you know, it's fuzzy. So that might help with some of these kinds of situations.
So Chris, when putting together the panel, encouraged us to disagree with each other. So finally, at the end of this panel, thrilled to have an opportunity to disagree with what Apu said. And the point that I'm going to disagree with is that in this society where there's a lot of information about you out there, the data mining required to dig up dirt on someone is going to be hard. I think it probably won't be that hard. And I'll give you two lines of evidence for that. One is the current data broker industry. Right? If you go to data brokers now and look up how much of your information they've aggregated from public records and social networks and all kinds of other sources and links to together and try to create a profile of you, that's quite enormous. And of course, they put a lot of effort into ensuring quality control of that. They're getting better as time goes on, and as there's more data, this quality control process only becomes easier because you have multiple sources reporting on each fact about a person, and you can use that to develop high quality signals. Another line of evidence is one of my favorite undergrad projects to give to students at Princeton who come looking for projects is to do this sort of dirt digging algorithm today, even with what's available about a person on the web. And students have come up with various creative ideas. If you have a person with a very common name like John Smith, and somebody wants to dig up, you know, information about their friend named John Smith online, but a Google search returns information about a dozen different John Smiths, can you use the link structure of these pages as well as the information that's on these pages to come up with a clustering algorithm that will cluster together all the Google search results among, say, the first 1,000 of each different John Smith? And it turns out that works pretty well. And he created this interface that, you know, presumably a stalker could use, but as a research project, where you put in a name and it gives you beautifully different clusters corresponding to all the different people with that name. And it even tries to pull together information from different web pages that combines, you know, different social media profiles and so on. So even in the scope of an undergrad project, you can imagine making a lot of progress on this question. But when you put that together with the power of the data broker industry, I think if it came to that, if there was enough of an economic incentive to solve this problem with people willing to pay $10, you know, to dig up dirt on their ex or whatever, I think that problem will get solved.
I'm glad somebody's not quite so sanguine about technology. I'm on your camp.
Okay. Well, I would like to thank our panelists. I think this has been a lot of fun and very enlightening.